The following message was preached at Redeemer Community Church. For more information about Redeemer, visit us online at www.redeemernc.org.
Today's scripture reading comes from Ecclesiastes 4, 4 through 10. I saw that all labor and all skillful work is due to one person's jealousy of another. This too is futile and a pursuit of the wind. The fool folds his arms and consumes his own flesh. Better one handful with rest than two handfuls with effort and a pursuit of the wind. Again, I saw futility under the sun. There is a person without a companion, without even a son or brother. And though there is no end to all his struggle, his eyes are still not content with riches. Who am I struggling for, he asks, and depriving myself of good things? This too is futile and a miserable task. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their efforts. For if either falls, his companion can lift him up. But pity the one who falls without another to lift him up. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. You may be seated. Thanks, Kay. So when I was a kid, we would sometimes watch the game show The Price is Right during summer vacation. The show was hosted by Bob Barker before he moved to Fuquay. If you've never seen the show, it's a bunch of different games that all center on correctly guessing the price of items. So they might, in one game, have a number of grocery items, and you have to guess how much the bar of soap and the box of cereal and the bunch of bananas cost. And whoever gets closest to the right price without going over wins the prize. I was thinking about it. As a parent, I would have loved to have watched the show with my boys on it when they were younger, because they knew the price of nothing, except for maybe a video game and basketball shoes. Like, I could just imagine them putting a vacuum cleaner out there, and my boys, when they were younger, having to guess how much it cost. They might have guessed $5 or $5,000. I mean, who knows? Because their lack of life experience of having to buy things would show up in their inability to determining how much something was worth. The older we get, the more experience we gain, the more we have to buy things, the better we get at determining value, at least when it comes to groceries and appliances. I'm not sure that we always get better at determining what is truly valuable. Like, age doesn't necessarily mean we invest our time and energy more wisely. So if you were to analyze the past 6 months of your life, how would you grade your investments? Did you value the right things? Well, over the past 6 months, if you were to look back, could you say, yeah, I put my time and I put my energy, I put my effort in the things that really matter? Adam was telling me about an old friend of his who isn't attending church right now, because he makes too much money bartending on Saturday nights. He told Adam it's hard to pass up $400 a night. So his friend is making a value judgment, but his calculations are faulty. He's like a prospector who ignores the gold nugget to fill up his bags with sand. So the teacher of Ecclesiastes has been raising these questions about what is truly valuable as he confronts this reality that life is short, death is coming. He wonders what makes life worth living. And here in chapter 4, he's going to compare riches and relationships and help us see what is truly valuable. Now, his conclusion is not surprising. We all probably already know that it's true, but we struggle to live like it's true. He'll show us that if we prioritize riches over relationships, we'll actually find ourselves poor in the end. So at the beginning and end of the chapter, we see the poverty of riches, and then sandwiched right in the middle, he shows us the value of relationships. So first, let's look at the poverty of riches. Last week, as we ended, Don was teaching, the issue of injustice was sort of where the passage ended in verses 1 through 3, right? And in the face of just overwhelming cruelty and abuse, the teacher says that sometimes it feels like it would be better to have never been born. Like, he's so overcome by all of the injustice he's seen around him that he's just overwhelmed, right? People with money and people with power are taking advantage of those who have no means to protect themselves. And so here, as he transitions from the topic of injustice to the topic of money, he warns us that it's possible to have a fat bank account and be poor. In fact, the pursuit of riches often leads to an impoverished life. Look at verse 4. He says this, I saw that all labor and all skillful work is due to one person's jealousy of another. This too is futile in the pursuit of the wind. So he begins with an observation. It's really a general statement about what motivates people. So he's looking around and he says, it looks to me like everyone is pursuing money because they're jealous of what the other people around them have. Now remember, he's speaking in a proverbial way. He's not making a definitive statement that every time in human history when someone did something skillful, it was motivated by jealousy. He's saying, when you look around, it seems that way. We have a phrase to describe this in our culture, right? We say that someone driven by jealousy, they're keeping up with the Joneses, right? This is an idiom that implies that one family is trying to maintain the same standard of affluence as a fictional family, the Jones family, right? So there's always someone out there, the Jones family, doing a little bit better than you are, and so you're motivated to work more and earn more and spend more to keep pace with the Joneses, keep up with their lifestyle, right? So why do we go to work? Why do you want a promotion? Why do you need to buy that new thing? Well, because you're keeping up with the Joneses. Now, I would guess that if I ask you, are you motivated by jealousy? You'd be quick to say, no. But I wonder if that's because we don't actually take time to honestly evaluate our motives. If jealousy really isn't a problem, why is it included in the Ten Commandments? So God gives his people just 10 commandments. And here's the final one, Exodus 20, verse 17. Do not covet jealousy. Do not covet your neighbor's house. I mean, I would never be jealous about someone's house. Okay. Do not covet your neighbor's wife or his male or female servants. In other words, the power, the authority, the influence he has, or his ox or donkey, his car, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. So you see, your covetousness or jealousy is included with murder, adultery, stealing, and lying. Right? It's a pretty big deal. Why do you go to work? Well, I go to work to make money. Well, why do you need money? Well, because I need to buy something to eat, and I need to buy a place to live, and I need to provide for my family. But is that all you really spend your money on? Just the bare necessities? Is it possible that a certain standard of living has become a requirement to you? And is it possible that standard of living is based upon how you see others living? Be careful that your effort is not driven by jealousy. See, jealousy is serious because jealousy makes obeying the second great command impossible. When Jesus was asked, what's the greatest command? He said, well, the greatest command is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And really, he's just summarizing the first part of the Ten Commandments. And he says, and the second commandment is just like this, love your neighbor as yourself. There he's summarizing the second part of the Ten Commandments. But you can't love your neighbor as yourself if you're jealous of what your neighbor has. Like, that's impossible. Jealousy and love for your neighbor are like magnets that when you push them together, they repel each other. And the harder you push, the more powerful the resistance. If you're jealous of someone, you will seek your good over their good. You will not love them. See, jealousy is harmful to our neighbors, but it's not just harmful to neighbors, it's harmful to our own soul. The writer of Proverbs says, a tranquil heart is life to the body, but jealousy is rottenness to the bones. Jealousy rots you from the inside out. It's like an acid eating away at your insides. Do you realize that often low self-esteem is produced by jealousy? Like, so here's what happens. We see what another person has. Maybe it's their abilities. Like they're one of those people who's good at everything. Or it's the money. And they seem to have gotten every break. Or it's what they look like. Man, she's just so beautiful. Or it's a reputation. This is what people think of them or what they've accomplished. And we look at it and we say, I wish I had what they have. And we don't. And so what happens is this comparison, this desire, this jealous desire causes us to elevate them and to look down upon ourselves. I mean, have you considered that maybe the reason you feel like a failure is because you keep comparing yourself to someone else, someone you admire, someone you're jealous of, And so what happens, instead of thanking God for the good things in your life, you feel like a failure. I've done nothing. Everything's worthless. So verse 4 warns us about pursuing riches out of jealousy, that we want what that person has. But then verse 5, it warns us that it's possible to swing the pendulum so far the other side that we find ourselves in a type of laziness that's self-destructive. Look at verse 5. It says, "The fool folds his arms and consumes his own flesh." So instead of working hard to keep up with others, it says the fool folds his arms. He refuses to work. Even when he has no food and he can only gnaw on his fingers, he still refuses to work. The same image is used in Proverbs as a warning against laziness. Proverbs 6, "How long will you stay in bed, you slacker? When will you get up from your sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the arms to rest, and your poverty will come like a robber, your need like a bandit." You see, both the jealous worker and the lazy fool, they fail to love their neighbor as themselves. So the worker, he makes plenty of money, but he refuses to share it. And then you have the lazy person who refuses to work and make money. And so he has nothing to share. And so even though their actions and their lifestyle look like polar opposites, the root issue is the same. Both are absorbed with themselves and their desires. Is there a better way? Look at verse 6. "Better one handful with rest than two handfuls with effort and a pursuit of the wind." So in verses 5 and 6, we find three distinct images that focus on human hands. And what I want you to do is I want you to picture them as paintings in a museum. So you walked into the museum, you're there in the gallery, and in front of you on the wall are three paintings, same size, same frames, all feature hands, but all portray something different. So there in the first painting, there's a picture of two hands, and these two hands are holding on to lots of stuff. And so as you look close to the painting, you see the hands are straining. The skin is stretched tight over the bones and tendons. The veins are bulging. Sweat has formed on the palms, and you can tell by the painting that these hands seem to be losing their grip on all the stuff. The feeling you get as you look at that painting is one of anxiety, right? Someone is about to drop what they've worked hard for. There's nothing they can do. They just don't have any more room in their hands. The second painting is of two hands that are folded together. These hands aren't straining like the first painting. In fact, the hands are pale, sickly looking. They're weak and decrepit. These hands are empty. And they give the impression of being lifeless. And the feeling you get looking at the second painting is sadness. Like there seems to be nothing of worth or value left. And then there's a third painting. This painting is of two hands. One hand is palm up, and in the palm are some treasures. Like nothing that's overly impressive, but you can tell that these treasures are maintained with love and care. And the treasures, they rest comfortably in the hand. They're not being squeezed too tightly, but they're not held carelessly. The other hand is empty, and it seems to be reaching or maybe motioning. And the movement implied by the second hand is not, it's not aggressive or anxious, but it's welcoming. And the overall impression of the third painting is one of peace and contentment. So I'd ask you, as you stare at those three paintings on the wall of the gallery, which painting best describes your hands? Are your hands always straining for more? Are they exhausted, trying to manage everything, to hold on to what you want and make sure it doesn't escape? Or are your hands empty? Are they the hands of someone who's given up? Someone who doesn't care anymore, someone who's entitled or lazy? Or are your hands relaxed? Are you holding lightly to the good things God has given you? Do you have a free hand to reach out and help someone else? See, the teacher here, he wants us to see that contentment is more valuable than riches. It's better to have a quiet soul than a fat wallet. I love how one Bible teacher defined rest here in verse 6. He said this, "It's a word to capture the deep well-being of those who know their place in the world, content with the boundary lines of their life, and able to enjoy the fruits of their labors with a cheerful heart." I mean, does that describe you? Or are you busy trying to hold on to something else? trying to grab and attain something more. So brothers and sisters, I plead with you to pursue contentment instead of advancement. Contentment instead of advancement. Here's what the Apostle Paul told Timothy. He said, but godliness with contentment is great gain. In other words, Timothy, you really want to gain something? Be content. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out. If we have food and clothing, we'll be content with these. But those who want to be rich fall into temptation, a trap, and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, and by craving it, some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Why are you working so hard? This is a question that's come up in many forms in Ecclesiastes, isn't it? What are you trying to gain from all your effort? Are you working so hard so that you can please God? I want to be diligent because my Father in heaven, he's given me this job and he's given me the opportunity, he's given me the energy to work hard and be diligent. Are you working hard so you can share with others? I want to be able to be a blessing to others. I want to have a hand that's free to help others. Or are you hoping to get ahead? Are you searching for something elusive? See, our problem is that we think the way to find contentment is to make more money. If I just got a raise. If I found a new job. If I earned my bonus, then I'd be fine. And that's a lie. Thinking more money will make you content is like thinking another glass of salt water will quench your thirst. The old Puritan preacher Jeremiah Burroughs wrote a book called The Rare Jewel of Christian Contentment, and he said this. He said, the Christian has another way to contentment. He can bring his desires down to his possessions. See, your soul will never find quiet by accumulating more possessions. Each possession further clutters your soul. And the only way then to find contentment is to loosen your grip on the things you have. Bring your desires down, not your possessions up. See, in this way you'll be like Jesus. For when Jesus walked the earth, he had very few possessions. In fact, he famously said, foxes have dens and birds have nests, but I have nowhere to lay my head. And yet Jesus was content. Everything Jesus needed fit in one hand, and with the other he reached out to save those who were lost. So here now the teacher gives us two examples of how riches can actually make you poor. The first example is a lonely businessman. Look at verse 7. Again, I saw futility under the sun. There's a person without a companion, without even a son or brother, and though there is no end to all his struggles, his eyes are still not content with riches. Who am I struggling for, he asks, and depriving myself of good things? This too is futile and a miserable task. I mean, what a sad picture. Here's a man who's given his life to accumulate wealth, and now he has no one to share it with. So there he sits in the restaurant after acquiring another company, and he's got the nicest bottle of champagne in front of him, but he has no one to make the toast. His life is a series of financial victories, but the path to victory is littered with discarded relationships. So do you see his quest for prosperity has dehumanized him? Because he has forsaken what makes a person truly human, which are relationships. And he's become like an animal who simply devours everything around him. We see here that human flourishing is not a byproduct of financial success. So have you swallowed the lie that making more money would somehow improve your life? I mean, be honest. Is there a part of you that says, yeah, just make it a little bit more? Are you consumed by your job? Do people admire your success from a distance even though you feel like a failure deep down inside? Verse 8 reminds me of this haunting song that was sung by the Beatles. Eleanor Rigby picks up the rice in the church where her wedding has been, lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who's it for? Father McKenzie writing the words of a sermon that no one will hear. No one comes near. Look at him working, darning his socks in the night when there's nobody there. What does he care? And then this chorus, all the lonely people Where do they all come from? All the lonely people, where do they all belong? So, brothers and sisters, what are you prioritizing in your life? See, one way that we can live distinct lives in this world is by intentionally and proactively choosing relationships over riches. When we value people over promotions, we reflect the values of Jesus and people take notice. Here's the second example of how riches can make you poor. It's that of a foolish king. Look at verse 13. Better is a poor but wise youth than an old but foolish king who no longer pays attention to warnings. For he came from prison to be king. Even though he was born poor in his kingdom, I saw all the living who move about under the sun follow a second youth who succeeds him. There's no limit to all the people who are before them, yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. This too is futile in the pursuit of the wind. Now this isn't pointing to a specific king in Israel's history. You could sort of pull different details from different kings. But notice this king has achieved great success and power. Like, he rose from poverty to sit on the throne. This sounds like a Disney movie. But notice he takes no companions with him on his meteoric rise. There he is at the top. Got servants, he's got soldiers, he's got entertainers, but he doesn't have friends. He has no one to share success with, no one that he will listen to. And it says, here's the end result. He will die and be forgotten. He will be replaced. And it says, and when he's dead and when he's forgotten and when he's replaced, what good were all of his successes? You see, this king is the opposite of King Jesus, who gave up his throne and became poor so that he could make us rich. Jesus valued people over possessions, and he taught his disciples to do the same. In fact, he told them, don't worry about food or clothing. Your Father, who owns everything, will provide your needs. Instead, value what he values. Seek first his kingdom. Love him and love others more than you love success and prosperity. Jesus is the king who chooses to be born in poverty, and when he is exalted to the throne of the universe, he brings his friends and family with him. The king of the universe is described as the friend of sinners. And he became the friend of sinners so he could lead those sinners from misery to hope. And so here the teacher wants us to see the poverty of riches so that we don't waste our life pursuing a type of success that leaves us empty. I mean, what a waste to get to the top and realize how lonely you are. And then in the middle of the passage, he shows us a different way to live. So he wants us, in contrast to riches, to see the value of relationships. I love the phrase David Gibson uses to describe this chapter. He says this chapter is about we, not me. We, not me. I know I spend way too much time thinking about myself, how I feel, what I want, what I need to get done, my hopes, my dreams, my plans. And I spend too little time thinking about others. And if I'm honest, I see way too much of myself in the lonely businessman and the foolish king. But verses 9 through 12 are a corrective to our hyper-individualistic culture, a culture that is all too easy for us to imitate. Look at verse 9. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their efforts. For if either falls, his companion can lift him up. But pity the one who falls without another to lift him up. Also, if two lie down together, they can keep warm. But how can one person alone keep warm? And if someone overpowers one person, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not easily broken. These verses are often used to describe marriage. Maybe you've heard them read at a wedding ceremony. And while they apply to marriage, they are not primarily about a husband and wife. These verses are about the benefits of companionship. How life lived in relationships is better than a life marked by riches. They show us that the real treasure around us are the people that God has placed in our lives. It's, verse 9 says, listen, it's much better to work with someone and find success than work by yourself. Because not only are your efforts multiplied, but your reward is sweeter when you share it with someone. Verse 10, if you work by yourself and you struggle, there's no one to help you. And if you work with a companion, then you have a helping hand when the burdens just get too much for you. Verse 11, if you're traveling and the night gets cold, you and your companion can share a blanket and that combined body heat under the blanket helps you both stay warm. Now that one, It seems a little weird to us, right? Because we have the benefit of heat and air conditioning. But in previous generations, there were companions who would sleep back to back under a blanket because the only way to stay alive in the cold was to have that body heat. If you were by yourself, you might not wake up in the morning. Verse 12 tells us that traveling by yourself also makes you a target for bandits. Safety comes in numbers, so if traveling with one friend helps, then traveling with two friends makes you even stronger. See, verses 9 through 12, they're just a poetic way to remind us of the beauty of friendship and the universal need for companions. You know, when God created man, in that week of creation, God kept making things, and he kept announcing the same thing. He said, this is good. This is very good. And there was only one thing on that week of creation that he said was not good. And that's when he put Adam in the garden, and he said, it is not good for him to be alone. See, we are made for community. We find safety and joy in the presence of others. In the movie The Batman Begins, there's a scene where the sort of the one not corrupt cop, Commissioner Gordon, he's wondering what he can do with such rampant corruption throughout Gotham City. Like, what can one man do when there's so many that are corrupt? And at that moment, sort of Batman steps out of the shadows and he says, now we are two. Right? We, not me. See, we find safety from outside forces and community. But more than that, in those dark nights of the soul, we discover spiritual warmth in the presence of our friends. Sin ever pushes us inward, and that can be a scary place. Like, we can get so trapped in our own hearts, so caught up in our own thoughts, so overwhelmed by our own anxieties that we find ourselves in a dark place. And God gives us friends to help draw us out in those moments. When you least want to see your friends, you most need them. When you crave the solitude of dark thoughts, you need companions who will walk you into the light. Do you see your need for others? Are you invested in building and maintaining healthy friendships? Brothers and sisters, relationships take work, and they are messy, but they are some of God's greatest gifts to you. And so you and I need to prioritize other people. We need to schedule time for conversation and community. You were never meant to be a lone pilgrim on a solitary journey from earth to heaven. You are part of a pack of pilgrims, and you need to open up your life to other people. If you are too busy for other people, you are dangerously, sinfully, and arrogantly busy. One writer on Ecclesiastes said, fellowship is more than sharing a cup of coffee after the service. It is sharing life together, sharing sorrows, fears, and pain so that together we might fight the good fight, together we might finish the race, together we might keep the faith, and together we long for the glory of Christ's appearing. Are you sharing your life with other Christians? In verse 12, it describes biblical relationships, healthy relationships, as a rope where the different lives like strands are woven together. So if a TV, a camera crew had been following you around for the past week, sort of they're just recording you throughout the day, would someone watching that film of your life, would they see that your life is woven together with other Christians like strands in a rope? Would that be their impression? Like, wow, their life is so tightly knit. It's coiled together with other Christians. Now, I know there are a thousand other things competing for your time and attention. Your job, your kids' schedules, your time at the gym, on and on the list goes. But let me ask you, how important will those things seem if sin crushes you and you have no one there to lift you up? Like, open your life up to others. Invest in relationships. Now, one way do we do this is by rejecting the cultural mindset that we need to entertain each other. Right? HGTV tells us that we need a home suitable to entertain. How many of you have seen House Hunters? What a waste of time. Every single person looking for a house says the same thing. We just want a house to entertain. See, the Bible tells us we don't need a house for entertaining, we need a home for hospitality. And those two words are drastically different because entertaining is exhausting. Just think about the word. You're entertaining someone. That requires you've got to put a show on for them. Everything has to be in its place, everything prepared, everything staged for maximum enjoyment, entertainment for them. No wonder we don't want to do that. Hospitality can be invigorating because it's simply inviting people into your life. We need to have friends who can eat sandwiches with us while wearing sweatpants because that's what life calls for. Like unfussy friendships that don't require hours of preparation. All they need is to be physically present. Listen, if you only invite someone over to your home if it's clean, you're setting a dangerous precedent for your soul. Because here's what you're saying. You may not realize this, but this is what you're saying. I'll only show you the parts of my life that are put together. You'll only see the manicured part of my life. Listen, you need friends that see the real unfiltered you, the you that needs Jesus, the you that needs others' help. And so maybe the first step you need to take in authentic and honest friendship is inviting someone over to your house while it's dirty. Like, let them see who you really are. Let them see how life really is. Because friends that know the truth about you and still love you are God's greatest gifts to you. And it's these types of friendships that help us endure when life is hard. There's an old African proverb which says, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. Do you want to go fast or do you want to go far? True friends help you go far. And the type of friendship that we're describing here is compelling, and it's a compelling witness to our world because everyone in your neighborhood, let me just tell you something about every single one in your neighborhood. I don't even know where you live, but I'm right. They're lonely. Every person there, lonely. Everyone in your apartment building, guess what? They're lonely. All the lonely people, where they come from your neighborhood, and they come from your apartment, and they come from your workplace. And you know what they desperately want? They want friends who will love them. Friends they can be honest with. I read a book last week about people who are leaving churches. And what they say overwhelmingly, when asked, what would it take for you to go back to church? They say, it would take someone inviting me. What they long for is a sense of belonging. And one of God's good gifts to us, a Redeemer here, is a strong sense of community. A warmth that is unusual in our world. Listen, we've got to be diligent about this. We need to make sure the Redeemer is never a place where someone can walk in, sit by themselves, and leave without ever having a real conversation. If you see someone sitting by themselves at Redeemer, I want the sirens to go off in your brain. Right? This is an emergency. So go, introduce yourself, sit down, and make a new friend because you have no idea the difference one friend can make. We, not me. Like every Sunday when you show up and as you walk in the doors, repeat this phrase to yourself between the parking lot and your seat in the auditorium. Repeat the phrase, we, not me. We, not me. Like, don't come on Sundays saying, what can I get out of this service? Come saying, who can I serve? How can I encourage someone? We, not me. throughout the first four chapters, the teacher of Ecclesiastes has been systematically dismantling the idols that we think will provide us what we desperately need. So in this chapter, right, he has ruthlessly targeted this desire and longing for riches, and he shows us how feeble wealth really is. But he doesn't leave us without hope, because after he exposes the poverty of riches, he shows us that there's something valuable all around us. It's relationships. Money and success are meaningless. Relationships, friendship, companionship, this is priceless. His message reminds me of how the Apostle Paul pictured the gospel in 2 Corinthians. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. Though he was rich, for your sake he became poor, so that by his poverty you might become rich. Jesus valued us over his eternal comfort. Jesus valued his people over the glory of heaven. Jesus suffered and died alone so that we would never have to be alone. Jesus gave up the true riches of unbroken communion with his Father so that he could bring us into that unbroken communion. Because of what Jesus did, we can be called a friend of God. Are you a friend of God? You're a friend of God by faith in Jesus. That's all it takes. This is the beauty of the gospel, the good news, that when Jesus became sin and he died in our place, his offering means that we can be made righteous and join him in God's presence forever. God's people in God's presence, enjoying God's unending blessings forever and ever. So, brothers and sisters, when we value people over possessions, we embody the gospel. We walk in the footsteps of Jesus. And so I want to encourage you, keep up with the Joneses, but not by emulating their lifestyle. Keep up with the Joneses' soul. Find out how the Joneses are doing. Rejoice with the Joneses when they rejoice. Weep with the Joneses when they weep. Let's be a church that keeps up with each other, that doesn't see relationships as disposable, that treasures people over possessions, that says we, not me. Pray with me. Father, we stand on the shore, and the tide of our culture keeps pushing us towards money and accomplishment and success as the means for fulfillment. And we need your grace to stand against it. Lord, you have given us through Jesus all we need to say no to this temptation of riches. Besides that, you've given us brothers and sisters standing on each side of us to link arms so that together we can live out this reality that our fulfillment and joy is not found in successes or riches or achievements or reputation. It's found in knowing Christ and being known. So, Father, we ask, give us the grace this week to walk together in true community. I pray this in Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you for listening to this message from Redeemer Community Church in Fuquay-Varina, North Carolina. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission. For more sermons, we invite you to visit us online at redeemernc.org.